Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Tuesday Topics. This is Paul Edwards from Miami, Florida, and it's a pleasure to welcome you to this week's edition. I'd like to thank our producer, Brian Charlson, who has put together, as per usual, an interesting and exciting program for us. I'd like to thank our recorders, including Rachel Bader, and would like to thank whoever ends up with the exciting task of editing our Tuesday Topics program for this evening. And of course, finally, I'd like to thank George Byes of Talking Communities, whose generosity in creating and making this kind of chat technology available through Talking Communities makes these programs possible. So thank you a lot, George. Our topic this evening is sailing. Often we hear about blind people getting involved in sailing because they're interested in sailing around the world, or they get in the news because they're doing something amazing and solo. But the sailing that we're going to talk about tonight is competitive international regatta sailing that involve blind people as the crew of various boats. And we have four people who are a part of that community tonight. One of them, Arthur O'Neill, will kind of be on the sidelines for technical reasons. He'll occasionally contribute some text messages, but for the most part, he'll kind of be on the sidelines because among us, we could didn't get his microphone functional this evening. We do have a gentleman whose name is Matt from Massachusetts, and maybe I'll ask him if he will start off and talk a little bit to us about what's going on with sailing where he is. So, Matt, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got involved and a little as well about where you stand now with sailing.
Okay, Paul. Thanks for having me on tonight. Basically, I started sailing when I was a student back at Perkins School for the Blind over 30 years ago when I was in the 11th grade. There was an experimental program that Perkins had in combination with Community Boating Inc., which is a public sailing center in Boston. And during the spring session, a few of us were invited out to do some sailing. We learned some basic things in terms of steering and that sort of thing. And then after graduating from high school, I went to college and graduate school, didn't pay any attention, to sailing for a while. And about 8 years later, decided that, I heard about the Carroll Center starting up a sailing program. I thought, oh, gee, it's something that I was interested in. I enjoyed it before, and, it's sort of like cornflakes, try them again for the first time. So I signed up with the Carroll Center to do some sailing and have been sailing ever since then, and that was back in 1980. And in that time, I've had the pleasure of participating in 5 World Blind Sailing Championship regattas. The first one was Auckland, New Zealand in 92, Fremantle, Australia in 94, Weymouth, England in 97, Miami in 1999, and then Lake Garda, Italy in 2003. The next World Blind Sailing Championships will actually be taking place in Newport, Rhode Island. So that will be my 6th World Blind Sailing Championship. And it's a celebration, to me, it's a celebration of the blind and sighted working together as a team to make the boat go fast around the course. And it is also an international competition of our competing against our other peers who are blind or visually impaired. That, in a nutshell, is where my sailing career started and where it is as of today.
We are privileged to have two of the members of the Canadian sailing team who are both from Toronto, Ontario, and who have been kind enough to join us this evening. And let me ask them a little bit about how they got started, and if one of you guys would transmit, give us your name first, and tell us a little bit about who you are and how you got involved. And maybe one of you, tell us exactly how blind sailing works. That is, how many people are on each boat, how many people are totally blind, how many people are sighted, and how the duties are divided, so to speak.
My name's Dave Greenwood. I started sailing about 20 years ago. Started with windsurfers. I've only been to one Worlds, and that was the Miami 99. And as you asked about how the blind sailing thing all works, well, there's 4 people on each boat, 2 sighted, 2 visually impaired. There's 3 classifications. B1, B2, B3. B1 is totally blind. B2 is, I don't know the percentages, but it's somewhere between totally blind and about 3 or 4%, something like that. And B3 is up to 10%, I guess, and that's still legally blind, but... Well, having more sight than the B2 classification. In the boat, you have a tactician who's sighted, and they don't touch any of the equipment. They're there to do the planning on where the boat's going to go and who does what, whether something needs to be trimmed or what have you. They're pretty well in charge. You've got a person at the helm who's visually impaired, and then there's another visually impaired person who would either do would probably be working the sheets, either the main sheet, which is the rope, the line that controls the mainsail, or they'd be working on the jib sheets, the foresail sheets, which are the ropes that control the trim of the foresail.
Tell us a little bit about, if you would, and I'm sorry I didn't write your names down, I really should have, so I apologize, but tell us a little bit about the size of the boats and whether there is a standard that needs to be kept to by all of the international competitors in terms of boats. And from what I gather, we're talking about a boat with two masts and two sails, and perhaps you can tell us a little bit more about the boat.
That's Randy Nelson here, and I'm relatively new. I've only been a member of the Blind Sailing Association of Canada for a year and a half, and almost 2 years now, and was glad to be able to sign aboard, and this will be the first time I'm going to any sort of a championship. So the boats that we'll be using are two different ones. We're competing in both the B2 and B3. David Greenwood will be with David Brown, and I will be competing with Frances Lake, a lady. And we'll be using a J22. Both sailboats that we'll be using are 22-foot sailboat, and the one that we'll be sailing is the J22 for the B3s, and the B2s will be sailing sonars, so they're 22-foot long as well. They only have one mast, but they do have two sails, a main sail and the foresail, and I'm really looking forward, and I'm really sorry that we cannot hear from Arthur. I'll be looking forward to meeting him and the others, and Matt, boy, you're so experienced. I think we'll have a lot of fun meeting all of you. So this is a great opportunity for us to come down from Toronto here and compete with all of you. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, I'm looking forward to having you guys down in Newport. It's nice to have the World Blind Sailing Championships on this side of the world. And not only is it a great time for competition, but it's also a really nice time socially. You know, we all get together and have a good time talking about either the race that got away or just enjoying the ambience of being amongst sailors who have practiced long and hard to get to where they are today.
Now, Matt, are you a B1, B2, or B3?
I am actually, in terms of my vision, a B1. But I will be competing in the B2 class. It sounds a little bit confusing, but in fact, you can actually go up a division, but you cannot go down a division. In other words, a B3 sailor who has, let's say, 20 over 200 in terms of vision, helmsman can't go down to a B2 class and compete in that class. By the way, it should be noted that each of the divisions in which the crew participates, the person who is driving or helming the boat determines the classification that crew will be in. So I could be in a B1 or B2 class, or B3, but a B3 helmsman cannot go to a B2 or B1 helmsman class.
It's interesting to imagine a blind person actually being the person who is responsible for steering the boat. For some of us, that may require some explanation. Does the tactician essentially then provide that individual with some instructions about the present location of other boats and the kind of direction that he recommends and when turns need to happen and that sort of thing, and And Matt, why don't you take that?
What basically happens is, as Randy mentioned, there are two blind crew and two sighted crew. One of the crew is actually the helmsman or the driver. Basically, what happens is I'm a helmsman in terms of my primary job. I can crew in the front of the boat, but I prefer to drive. What happens is that the process of a good sailing team involves a lot of practice, a lot of coordination, a lot of communication. That is the key. If you can't communicate with the person who's giving you direction and understand exactly what needs to be done and when it needs to be done, then you won't have a boat that's really competitive. This takes a lot of time on the water, a lot of experience, a lot of give and take between the blind crew member and the sighted crew member, the tactician. And what happens is that as the more you race and the more experienced you become, the more you understand what, when, and how things need to get done in terms of steering. How much helm to apply, how much helm to release, when to tack, which is the process of bringing the bow of the boat or the front of the boat through the breeze, or jibing the boat, which means that you bring the stern of the boat through the breeze when you're sailing downwind. What will happen is, as you are steering through a course, a race, the tactician will say up 5 degrees or down 10 degrees. And it's not necessarily a compass heading. It is actually the amount of helm or the amount of steering that you do up into the wind or away from the wind that determines where the boat will go. At certain times during the race, the tactician or guide will tell you, tack in 3, 2, 1, now. So everything becomes a precision process, a very precise process. And you need that in order to keep the boat going fast on the race course, hopefully in front, and maintain your lead. There are other critical points in terms of rounding a mark, like a weather mark where you have to round the mark and go downwind and that sort of thing. And it's very close work between you, your sighted tactician, the other guide, and the jib trimmer or mainsail trimmer to make this all work. It's actually a ballet, for lack of a better description, between all four crew members.
Let's talk a little bit more about the course, and let's let the folks in Canada talk a little bit about this. Wow, we're getting all sorts of information about Arthur, who apparently won a silver medal in England in 1997 for his abilities, and who also, I guess, has been responsible for developing some specific techniques for... Matt won the silver. Ah, there we are. Sorry, Matt. But Arthur, I guess, has worked specifically on developing some approaches that folks have to convey wind condition when moving downwind, so that you can get more precision in terms, I guess, of how the foresail gets appropriately handled. But let's talk for a few minutes about... I'll have Matt do that. We just got a text message from Arthur saying that it's Matt's method, and we will get Matt to talk to us about that in just a few minutes. A race course typically involves the use of, I would guess, a number of buoys, and requires you to round those buoys at particular times and in a particular order, and to travel the course in particular directions. But maybe you guys from Canada could talk a little bit about how a race course is laid out and what the expectations are. And let's do that. And then I'm going to talk a little bit to Matt about wind conditions. So let's have a little bit more about the way that a race course is laid out from the Canadian folks.
Oh, okay, this is Dave again. Now, I'm not sure how it's laid out this year. I suspect it's the same as the 99 course. There's two marks, two buoys on the course. The windward mark, that's the one that's the closest to where the wind's coming from, and the leeward mark, which is in the opposite direction, farthest from the wind. There was in 99, the start line was partway up the course, and you go around the course counterclockwise. And so you would start on the right side of the course, and you would go up the course and make a left turn or a turn to port around the first, the windward mark. Down the course, so you'd be running all the way. Running would be with the wind directly on the back of the boat. Then you would make a turn at the leeward mark and up again, and the finish line would be halfway up the course. Now, normally, it'd be twice around this course, but depending on the wind and so forth, that would be about it.
Matt, first, why don't you tell us about some of the specific techniques that you develop, and those are kind of exciting. And then maybe you could talk with us a little bit about how the tactics would differ depending on the kind of wind conditions that you have. So if you have a small to virtually no wind, you're going to have to operate your boat in an entirely different way than you would if you are having winds that are verging on gale force. So perhaps you could talk with us a little bit about some of the differences in the way that you'd organize operating a boat given different wind and sea conditions.
Okay, first, I'll talk about my downwind techniques. Basically, one of the trickiest points of sail or direction of sail is sailing downwind. And the reason that it's so tricky is because things can happen very quickly sailing downwind in terms of the boom coming over from one side to the other very quickly. It's called a jibe, J-I-B-E. A jibe is when the stern of the boat goes through the breeze. You're heading downwind. An example might be you're on a race course. You're up to what's called the weather mark or the windward mark. You make about a 90-degree turn. And as you turn, you're going off the breeze or downwind. And that can be up to like 90 degrees or so. And as you go downwind, the wind goes from the bow of the boat to the side to, let's say, the starboard side, towards the starboard quarter, which is towards the stern, towards what's called dead downwind, or sometimes we'll call it DDW, or downwind. And when you're dead downwind, it means that the wind is blowing directly over the stern and hitting the sail, both the mainsail and the jib. And what happens at that time is that we do what's called a wing-on-wing, which means that if you're on a starboard jibe, it means that the mainsail is on the left or port side of the boat, and the jib for the wing part is pulled over to the starboard side or right side of the boat, so that you have maximum sail area being pushed by the breeze. Now, at this particular point, sailing downwind, you don't just have the wind. You sometimes have waves as well, which can roll or push the boat out of the track that you want to follow to the leeward mark. And what happens there is, if you're not careful, the boat will jibe accidentally. It's called an accidental jibe. And that has some not so great consequences. Everything from losing position in terms of your position in the fleet to causing some serious damage because the maneuver was unexpected. Anyway, I developed a technique where I turn, when we sail downwind, I'll actually turn around and face the stern of the boat or face aft, and I will let the breeze, the breeze will be blowing over my face, and I can judge by what angle on my face it is whether I'm in a safe jibe position, position on that jibe or not. For example, from on a downwind leg on starboard jibe, wind direction from, let's say, the 10 o'clock position on my face to about slightly right of the 12 o'clock position is good. Sometimes you can go to what's called by the lee, which is at about 1 o'clock, but it's not always advisable, particularly if you have gusty and shifty air. So what I'll do is I'll sit on, let's say, in the J22 class, in which our Canadian friends are familiar. You probably are, well, I'll sit on the traveler bar, which is another technical term for an adjustment to the sails. I'll sit in the middle of the boat, and I'll have the tiller literally in my fingertips, facing directly aft. The wind will be blowing from, let's say, my 10 o'clock position on my face, about 1 o'clock. I know that's a good zone. Anything beyond that is beyond the 1 o'clock position on a starboard jibe is a no-go zone, because there's a chance that if you get hit by a wave or you get a wind shift, that you could accidentally jibe the boat, make the boom come over to the wrong side. So that's how I do the downwind technique, and it's actually developed out of the fact that when I was first learning to sail, the boat would for some unexplained reason jibe, and I didn't really like this very much because it was very uncomfortable. And in some smaller boats, if you're not careful, you can capsize the boat. So one thing led to another. I tried different techniques, and eventually I developed the technique that I use today. And it took years of trial and error, but it's at the point now where I can actually, I'll be calling off wind direction and I'll be telling the people up front is like winds at 10 o'clock, meaning relative to my face, winds at 12 o'clock. And I'll be listening at the same time to what the jib is doing to make sure that that trimmer still has that jib sail full. And if I hear it drop, if I hear it flap, it's like, okay, I have to correct accordingly. So it's a really complex process that takes a long time to develop. But once you get there, it makes things a lot easier.
Let's continue with you for just a second, Matt, because I want to kind of follow up on an issue. Presumably, if you're trying to utilize this technique, one of the factors that's going to make it either work well or not work well is going to be the degree to which the wind is actually blowing. So if you are at a place where there is very little wind and where you're having to work mightily to get any way at all to be made with the boat, I would presume that your technique is a good deal harder, whereas your technique would probably work most effectively where you've got a nice steady breeze and where it doesn't tend to be a shifting wind, but is a pretty steady breeze from a specific quarter. Would that be right?
Well, on a downwind, when you're sailing downwind and the air is light, it is the hardest position of sailing to read. But as you know, we practice in all kinds of breeze, be it light, moderate, or heavy. And the reason you do that, and I have to admit, I'm not really a light air sailor. I can't say I like it much. But by being able to practice in different velocities of breeze, overall you become a better sailor, and overall you're better able to adapt to changing wind conditions. In fact, you know, we've been on courses where the wind will be heavy in the morning. It becomes medium in the afternoon or in midday and becomes light and variable in the afternoon. In terms of tactics, breeze and direction, you know, the velocity of the breeze or the speed of the wind will determine, and your position on the race course combined will determine what your tactics are going to be. And a lot of that is left up to the tactician because they can quickly see what the positions are in terms of the fleet and plan their strategy accordingly. In terms of the helm and in terms of jib trimming, a lot of what we do will be determined by wind speed in terms of how much do you steer, how little do you steer, how much jib trim do you apply or release, how quickly do you move around the boat, how much weight is required up on the windward side to hold the boat down. There are cases where if the wind is really light, you want what we call leeward weight so that the helmsman has some feel in the tiller. Opposite, you know, the opposite holds true in terms of heavier, where you have winds of 12, 15, or 20 knots. That's when you want a lot of people up on the rail, or what some people will say in terms of extra crew would be rail meat. You want beef on that rail. You want to hold the boat down so that you track as straight as possible through the water. If your boat heel is too excessive, you will not be able to hold a straight course through the water, and in fact, you will side slip. So the key is to sail with a certain amount of boat heel, and it varies from one design class boat to one design class boat, but not to sail it so that there's so much heel that you're slipping sideways instead of going forward.
Canadians, do you want to add anything more about some of the techniques that get involved? David, perhaps?
I guess everybody has their own techniques. When I'm at the helm, I Matt's idea of facing backwards is great because your face is a lot more sensitive. But what I do is I make sure the back of my neck is well shaved before a race, so it is sensitive, and I just make sure the wind is centered pretty well as close to the back of my neck as possible. Techniques, well, there's a whole feel when you're keeping the boat in the groove. And what I mean by that is, let's say you're going upwind, and there's just a certain heel, a feel to the boat, that if you can maintain this, you get the best, you know, best speed from the boat. A lot of it is experience. There's no tricks I can say, you know, do this or do that. It's just you try a lot of things, and when it feels good, just stick with it. Other than that, I don't know if I could add anything else.
Arthur's been text messaging us and telling us a little bit about some of what will happen in the World Championships coming up in Rhode Island. Let me convey a little bit of that. In the first place, it'll start off with some opening ceremonies, and then there'll be a couple of days of practice sailing so that the teams from other parts of the world can get a chance to see what the waters in Rhode Island are like. And there will also be an evening where people will be required to do skits. There'll be a visit to at least one maritime museum where some of the inventions that surround sailing in the 19th century will be featured at those things. Matt or Canadians, whichever person wants to jump in first, you guys could tell us how the World Championship works. Is it a kind of a round robin exercise where people do kind of one race, and if you lose, too bad, or is it the best two out of three against each team? How do the World Championships work?
This is Matt here. Basically, what happens is it's not a round robin. Each division will race a certain number of races each day. What has often happened is that to make it equal, let's say the B1s might race in the morning on Wednesday, and on a Wednesday, and the B2s on Wednesday afternoon, and then the next day they might switch where the B2s will sail in the morning, and then the B1s sail in the afternoon to make it fair in terms of winds and tides and that sort of thing. It's basically a number of races that we will do over a couple of days. And what normally happens in a regatta is you're entitled to one throwout. That is to say, the worst race you did, if you have, let's say you had a whole bunch of bullets or first places and you had one last place, you can throw that last place out and you could win. That one worst race isn't counted. What will happen is that the schedule basically calls for practice the first 2 days, racing on Friday through Sunday, and a reserve day or lay day, and then there'll be some racing on Tuesday and or Wednesday with the award ceremony on Wednesday. So that's basically how the worlds are set up. The other thing that's important is that David mentioned, a while back, David was talking about the groove. And the groove is that feeling you get when the boat is at optimum performance, optimum speed. You know where that performance point is, and your job in terms of sailing to windward is to hold that performance point for as long as possible. You have to, of course, you have to adapt, you have to adjust according to weight and according to wind speeds and wind shifts. That is to say, the wind direction might change. But, if you sail certain boats over time, as you gain more experience, you learn to pick up the groove on different boats. But it's, the long and the short of it is that there is no substitute for on-water experience or practice. That's what makes everything come together, be it with your crew or on your own with an instructor guide. The time on the water is so critical to make the whole process happen.
Arthur was indicating that I guess the yacht club that's being used at least for part of the time is the famous yacht club in Rhode Island, where I guess the American's Cup happens at least to some degree. Wow. Arthur tells us that the New York Yacht Club is the host this year, and that it's done under the auspices of the International Blind Sailing Group another federation. Arthur also indicates that there's a new award this year that's going to be given to the best totally blind skipper this year, the best totally blind captain. Now, I don't know whether the captain is always the helmsman or not. One of you guys might want to clarify that. I just have one other question so that I get everything entirely clear. So all of the boats who are in a particular class will race in a given heat. So if we're doing a B1, if we're doing a B1 race, all of the B1 boats who are competing will actually race at the same time in part of that heat, and Arthur confirms that in fact is correct. So if someone would tell us something about the Oh, how cool. I'm going to ask Randy to talk about that in a moment. Randy, why don't you talk about what you just text messaged, which concerned the crossing of Lake Ontario by a group of you guys from the Canadian team. And at the same time, if you know the answer, Randy, tell us a little bit about how many teams that you know of that will be competing this year in the World Championship.
Arthur will expand on how many are coming. I understand there's about 7 to 8 countries coming and 20 teams that represent the B1, B2, and B3s. Now, we're only taking B2s and B3s, as well as some other countries are doing the same thing. They'll have a mixture of either B1s, B2s, or B3s. And actually, I think there's only about 4 or 5 countries that are actually bringing a full complement of teams. And in our preparations for the Canadian Blind Sailing Team, three members of our team, myself, Francis Lake, and David Brown, sailed across Lake Ontario in August on a Saturday and Sunday. On the Saturday, we sailed across, and on the Sunday, we returned. We had a little problem with the lack of wind. You know, those hot, hazy summer days aren't quite as windy as we'd like them to be. So we got about 80% of the way across and had to motor into Youngstown, and then got about, you know, almost halfway across before we had to motor across to Toronto, where we would have been out there for about 12 hours or more. So we basically did it back and forth in about 7-8 hours each way, and it was really a good opportunity for us to practice our skills. And we were in our boats ourselves. We had a safety boat with us that had 2 sighted people aboard, but basically the only thing that we used was a GPS unit that had a large face on it. We had difficulty finding a GPS unit that was talking, that was, you know, rugged enough to be, you know, waterproof and that. So I had to use a magnifying glass to watch the GPS as we tried to keep on course. And it was a lot, you know, given this was my first serious year of sailing. Last year I just came out and you know, just gave it a try, but I really wasn't learning a lot. This year I took it upon myself to learn a lot more about sailing. We David Greenwood organized a course for us to take, and I took that and passed it. And but really I needed to learn a lot about sailing. I mean, last year I didn't know what points of sail were or any of the real technical aspects of sailing. So this all culminated in us now, you know, I'm feeling very confident in being able to go to this and do well and represent Canada well, you know, given the fact that I've never actually been in a race other than, you know, evening races that they have on Lake Ontario here in Toronto. You know, we get to go out in the evening and you know, a yacht club will have a race amongst themselves, you know, but this is the first time I'll have a chance to compete, so I'm really looking forward to it.
Arthur tells us that there are in fact 21 teams from 9 countries, and also indicates that at least at this point in the World Championships, electronic GPSs won't be used. But Arthur says in his text message, and I'm inclined to agree, that probably in a few years, as talking GPSs become more widely available, they'll probably play a larger role, and we'll probably begin to see more, at least I'd love to see it, more blind-only, I guess I want to say that, more blind-only teams. In fact, let me throw that out. Will the GPS system enable blind teams to operate pretty independently, or are there some things about GPS that make it unlikely that they will that they will replace the use of sighted participants in races? So let's start with Matt, and then we'll hand it to Randy and David for some comments, and then we'll open it up for folks to ask questions.
In terms of use of GPS, to some extent, I guess the GPS and blind-only teams sort of go together in that there actually is a system by which blind folks can sail around a course in a match race mode, which means that you have one boat against another boat, not a fleet situation, which is what we do. We do fleet racing, which is whoever comes in first, second, third, etc. What happens is in match racing, you have two boats competing against each other going around the race course. Now, there's a project that's called Homeris, which uses primarily electronic aids, audible aids, that and David Greenwood has used this, that allow blind sailors to navigate a race course. What happens is that they have they're two blind crew. One is steering, one's doing trim, and there's a sighted person on the boat who keeps, basically, whose sole job is to keep them out of serious trouble. But there are a number of audible navigational aids that are used in terms of audible buoys that the boats steer towards and around. In fact, in Italy, there was a demonstration of Homeris, of this system. And it's a good system in terms of allowing people who are blind or visually impaired to go around a race course and to feel the control of the boat, steering and boat handling aspect. The only problem is that to make a course of this type available in any given area roughly costs, from my recollection, something on the order of $10,000 a boat. And given the fact that a lot of us don't have a lot of money to begin with, it becomes a pretty tall order. So in terms of GPS, I don't see GPS as being used in what we call round the buoys race or short course, round the marks race. However, if one were to do offshore racing point to point, let's say from Boston to Provincetown, it could become, if one were ever able to mount such a campaign, it could become a viable alternative. But for courses of this length, a short course, Windward Leeward, it's really not a practical thing because of the nature of the courses. Besides that, you would still need someone with vision in tight quarters to keep you from running up what I call a yard bill, a.k.a. a collision. I think that, blind sailing is still an evolving sport. It still has a lot of potential, and I see blind sailing as not just a means for us to compete against our peers, but as a means of integration, of blind and sighted working together as a unit, not as us an us and them kind of mentality. And to me, that's really the big part of the blind sailing movement, is that it's an integrative process, or what I call the great integrator, where all of us, all four of us on a particular boat, work like crazy to make the boat go fast and hopefully stay out in front.
Let's let the Canadian folks, either Dave or Randy, talk a little bit about GPS, and maybe you could describe the Homeris system a little bit more for us, if either of you guys know that. Arthur also indicates that the Homeris system is a system that is being used some in the U.S. and that he had a chance to see it demonstrated in Italy. So take it away, Canadians.
Last year, Dave Brown and myself, we went into the Homeris World Championships in Italy, and it was very different. We actually went in as just to try it out. We had no way of practicing back home. We didn't have the system, and we found it very different than the fleet sailing. I can't say one is better than the other. At the moment, I like the fleet method better, just because it's more teamwork. It's certainly a lot less nerve-wracking. The Homeris system, there's two blind people on the boat, and you do have a sighted person, but the sighted person actually is an umpire and is really there not to help you that much, but more we got more information like it's time to do your penalty now, rather than watch out for the boat ahead. The Homeris system has dropped in price considerably. It's not $10,000 a boat now. I think it's probably $6,000 for both boats, for three buoys and for the units on the boat. So it's getting a little more reasonable, but still it's pricier than the fleet sailing method. It doesn't use any electronics like GPS. It's just the feel of the wind, the sound buoys. You've got three sound buoys out there, and they all have different sounds, so you know exactly where you are on the course by triangulating, if you like, between the three sound buoys. It's an up and down like the fleet racing, and that's about it. There are two different methods of racing, and you can't really say one is better than the other. It's they're just both very different from each other.
Mr. Nelson, any sort of final comments on GPS Homeris versus fleet sailing before we open it up for questions?
No, just that I'd be interested in talking with Arthur, as he'd like to talk to me about thoughts on how new technologies works. I just found that when I was using that GPS, there is a delay, right? It's the same as when you're driving down the road using a GPS. There is a factor of a delay in there. And when you're in a race, for example, I would think that could throw you off more than it would be helpful. you know, as I said, it may be a longer, when you have to go a longer distance, it would help. But in short term, you know, I think you need to have other methods of feedback that would be more beneficial, like the Homera system, because it gives you an indication then where everyone else is as well, if you're a B1 or, you know, B2 level. So I think it would be more helpful in that way.
Arthur had also indicated that there is some real advantages to having the kind of teamwork and interaction that operates with fleet racing, and even an audible compass takes a while in order to get headings done properly. So it's more appropriate, Arthur says, for cruising than it is for the kinds of short courses that are typically involved with races. Okay, let's open it up. Do folks have questions or comments that they'd like to make for any of our three talking guests and one electronic guest?
This is Shelley in Orlando, Florida. And I have a couple of questions. I tuned in late, so I hope this isn't something that you have already covered. My first question is, can a totally blind person trim? And my second question is, as a person who would just, I'm not particularly interested in doing it competitively, but just for the enjoyment and sheer love of the water and just for the joy of doing it, who would you contact, or how would you go about getting the experience of just trying it out?
This is Matt here. To answer your first question about trim, yes, a blind person can trim. However, when it gets into the racing environment, the trimming is there's a lot more precision involved. We'll do things such as have pieces of tape between the points where you trim and you release your on the jib sheet and release. Sometimes when I practice sailing on my own, I will both drive and trim, and it's actually a very helpful tool because you know exactly what the boat will do when you do certain things in combination with each other. And over the long term, as a racer, I think it makes you a better racer because you have a better understanding of you know, sailing mechanics, steering mechanics, the things that you need to do to keep the boat going fast. As for your question about sailing recreationally, you know, that's what's nice about the sport, is that you can sail as easy or as hard as you want. Now, you got some hardcore guys like us, and you have easy guys, you know, guys who like to cruise. And both facets of sailing are great because you're out on the water, you know, it's sort of a peaceful process, you know, environment. And one of the biggest problems for a lot of folks who are blind or visually impaired is just getting out. And that's one way to get out and meet people and socialize, and it's a great thing. The thing that I can suggest in terms of getting involved in recreational sailing is find out if there's some sailing clubs in your area, particularly if they're public sailing centers, and maybe you can network with people there, get some lessons, and eventually go out. In fact, when I was up in Boston, we're sort of fortunate because we have the variety of places where you can go sailing and not have to pay an arm and 10 legs to do it, as well as in Newport. You know, you can actually get linked up and take some sailing lessons and get out there. And in my case, as I became more proficient, I would actually take people out for instruction. All they had to do was keep me out of trouble. As long as they knew what port and starboard were, as long as they knew how to help me land the boat or dock the boat. When I was at community boating, that's what I did. I actually took some people out, and I'd have them either, we'd take turns steering, or they'd want to work on jib trim or mainsail trim, and I would steer, and they would do what they had to do. You know, recreational sailing is definitely it's a lot harder to do competitive sailing on a long-term basis because, you know, racers, you know, come and go. They have other jobs. They move, whatever. And one of the things about a racing team is that continuity is the key. The more practiced you are as a team or a unit, the better off, the better you're likely to perform in races. So racing is really tough, especially when you look at it from a long-term commitment. I've been sailing competitively for about 26 years now, and it's not easy. There are times when you don't do well. There are times you do real well, but it's the willingness and ability to stick with to be committed to the sport. And I'm saying that as a racer. Now, as a recreational sailor, it's a lot easier in terms of, you know, you as long as you can find some sighted guides who are good sailors, you know, your ability to get out on the water and do what you want to do is a lot greater than, you know, trying to race all the time, which is a little bit tougher.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan. I think this is quite an interesting program tonight. I heard Matt on Marlena touch on it a little bit. It's quite interesting there, too. He and I share one thing. We are alumnus of a school for the blind in Michigan. Sailing is quite an interesting sport. I used to have a sailboat, or my brothers and I, when we were kids up at the lake where we were at, and it's sometimes fun to do. It's quite different, the sailing that you're talking about, than the blind fellow that did it on his own. Any of you have any comments on what you thought about this one blind fellow that went out on his own sailing all over the place?
Let me communicate a couple of things that Arthur has shared with us. First, he says that if you're looking at getting involved in recreational sailing, or in the long run in competitive sailing as well, it's really good to look for what are called community sailing programs rather than trying to operate through a private yacht club, which can tend to be a little pricey. You know, if you've got that circle of friends, why, that's lovely. But if you don't, then look for a community sailing program. Arthur also indicates that about 10% of the blind sailors are kind of hardcore racers, and the other 90% are far more recreational racers, and he believes that this also applies to sighted sailors as well. Arthur indicates that there are some programs that are specifically designed for blind folks. The Carroll Center has started a program which can be reached through going to the website www.blindsailing.org, and this will put you in touch with the Carroll Center program. There is also a disability sailing program that operates out of Miami here through an organization called Shake a Leg. And they're making a pretty substantial effort to get a blind sailing program up and running here, and in fact I think are sending some folks up to the championships as well. Blind Sailing Org is for international blind sailing. Thanks, Arthur. What is the Carroll Center website? And I'll hold on and keep the... Okay. Randy says folks in Canada who are listening can get hold of the Blind Sailing Association in Canada by going to www.blindsailing.ca. www.blindsailing.ca. Well, Anicio's moved to Atlanta, so I don't know if he's actually going to still be competing. I'm sorry he's not here tonight, because he's a pretty regular participant. Let's see if there are other questions or comments about blind sailing for our guests.
Brian here. I will disclose that I work at the Carroll Center, that Arthur tried to get me involved in blind sailing. I got excited about the prospect of it, read a couple of books on the subjects, and actually got to go sailing all of two times because of my weekend schedule through the summer months. But during that process, I was amazed at how much of the success or lack of success of skippering a boat, that is holding the tiller and, as Matt puts it, driving the boat, is really dependent on your ability to read the wind by its blowing against your face. Because actually, you're trying to, when the wind is behind you, trying to capture as much of that as possible. So the actual feel of the wind itself is offset by the fact that you're going in the same direction as the wind. And then when you're trying to sail into the wind, you're trying to control not only the rudder, but by the trim of the sails, trying to get just the right angle of the sails to cause the wind to flow over the face of the sail, creating a kind of a suction effect and drawing the ship forward rather than pushing the ship forward. And that, all of that concept is so unlike what I thought it was, that when we actually got out and started sailing, it felt like we were virtually becalmed when we were actually moving along at a decent clip. So I, again, can't echo more strongly what Matt was saying about experience on the water makes all the difference in your ability to enjoy the act of sailing as opposed to simply being breathing cargo.
Thanks, Brian. Yeah, I would concur with that. I did some sailing in the Caribbean when I was much younger, and it really is amazing just how difficult it actually is And one of the things that I noticed was how much you actually could hear about how well the sail was being filled with air and how well it wasn't, which was a much more common occurrence for me when I was sailing. Arthur also indicated that if there are kind of multi-disability programs that are available, like Shake a Leg, which were set up primarily to involve folks with physical disabilities, it's much more easy to get them involved in trying to set up and operate programs for blind sailors, because they're already primarily interested in making that happen, and multiply disabled programs tend to be the ones that are most successful. I know Shake a Leg is really growing here in Miami, we're getting a larger and larger number of participants in the physically disabled side. The number of blind sailors who are prepared to get involved and remain involved over the long haul seems to be an issue. There are folks who will get involved for a little while but not really stay involved. Arthur is mentioning that in 1999 we hosted the World Championships, and our local affiliate of ACB was directly involved with some of those ceremonies. And we also tried pretty hard to get junior and senior high school kids involved in getting to know some of the participants who were down here in 99 as well. So, other questions for our folks?
Not a question, but a comment. It's an easy good evening, everybody. When I lived in Maine, I participated in a group called, and I can't for the life of me remember the name, but it was something to the effect of Challenge Sailors. It was a group that actually started with the IRIS network where I was working. And while we did it mostly for fun and for recreation, I actually had an opportunity to participate in a couple of races, particularly one that was overnight. It was a 24-hour race, which was really one of the most wonderful experiences I've had, to be in the middle of the ocean and hear absolutely nothing but the rustling of the sails and the wind, and there's an island off the coast of Maine called, I believe it's called Rock Island, because it basically is just rock, and I know we went by that island around 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and you can imagine that was absolutely no sound except the waves on the rocks. It was probably one of the most beautiful memories I have of Maine. Now that I live in Atlanta, sailing is probably not as available for me, at least I have not investigated it. The ocean is pretty far away, but I highly recommend it. And for that lady, and I forgot her name, I'm sorry, that talked about recreation, it really is a wonderful thing, and you really don't have to really get engrossed in racing. Just being out there is a great experience. And if I may add, I believe that the person that started the program in Maine is an old disciple of Arthur O'Neill, too.
Arthur also mentioned that he thinks that what is really cool about sailing, even recreational sailing for blind folks, is that there is so much involvement in the control of trim and in the control of the sails and listening to that. And Arthur then says, and blind or sighted, you can't see the wind. And Randy from Canada very quickly responded, yeah, and it's the only thing that they'll legally let me drive up here in Canada. And Arthur's inviting all of us to come sailing with them anytime after the worlds are over. And last question, if there is one.
When the worlds are going on, are we going to be able to hear anything over the internet, like news reports or something about how they're going as they go on? I really wish we had had that, especially during the internationals, when it took a while for us to get the news of how things were going, knowing whether our teams were doing well or poorly, etc.
News will be coming out every day. Where could people look for that news, Arthur? Is there a particular website? Would blindsailing.org actually put out releases every day? And Arthur's also asking whether Brian would like to put a mic on the boat, and then we could transmit directly to the Carroll Center, and we could hear the sound of blind sailors cursing all over the world on the radio. That'd be kind of cool. I really have enjoyed one of the things that I enjoyed. I don't know if anybody else has done it, but I used to be a real kind of America's Cup freak. And one of the reasons that I think I was because the boats were mic'd, and because you could hear an awful lot of what was being said if you were a pretty careful listener and used headphones. And that was fascinating to listen to the the sounds of the boats, as well as the sounds of people responding to the needs of the race. Arthur's saying that there will be information on www.blindsailing.org every day, and the other website that you mentioned, Arthur, was www.mic. Could you? I didn't get that full website.
He means that it's the New York Yacht Club, so it's www.nyyc.org.
Correct. That should be it. This is Matt here. The other thing about you were talking about the America's Cup and things being mic'd, Paul. The interesting thing also about blind sailing is there sometimes as crews become more experienced working together, the communication may start off as a lot of communication, and as you get into more races and more racing, sometimes it actually becomes less. Now, believe it or not, I've been in situations where you'll hear monosyllabic things like up five, tack in 2 minutes or 2 seconds, you know, whatever the time interval is. And the rest of the time is silence. You know, you're steering your course, your sails are trimmed. And the only time that it really gets, that there's a lot of communication, is when you're at mark roundings or when you're really close to other boats. Interesting thing is that people talk about how close do you get. I mean, I've been asked this question a couple of times. At the level of sailing it, which we're competing, it is not uncommon to be within a few feet and sometimes even a few inches of other boats and still be able to steer and live there. But again, a lot of this comes about through experience on the water, through being in race after, you know, a number of races. A lot of it is the trust level that you develop between the blind and sighted members of the crew. That trust issue is key. There is no substitute for it. It's developed through lots of practice and lots of work. Sailing can be a recreational or a competitive sport.
Arthur offered the opportunity to mic a boat or two, and I think we might be able to pull something like that off.
One thing I'd like to mention here is you know, I'm really looking forward to competing and meeting all the other sailors from Canada and elsewhere. I'm honored to be part of the USA Team Massachusetts team and look forward to seeing everybody in Newport.
I'd like to thank our guests very much. We'd certainly be glad to present a segment down the road on how things went in the championship. Really appreciate all of the involvement of our guests this evening, and particularly want to thank our folks from Canada for jumping in at the last minute and becoming full-fledged guests. The websites that you can get information on the upcoming championships, again, are www.blindsailing.org, which is the International Blind Sailing Organization's website, and www.nyyc for New York Yacht Club.org. We wish teams the best of luck. I'd like to thank everyone for your participation this evening and for being a part of Tuesday Topics. Next week on Tuesday Topics, we'll be exploring people who are blind and the paratransit system. Paratransit is a complementary system of transportation that involves using vans or cars rather than the city bus system, because the city bus system, for one or other reason, isn't accessible to the folks who use paratransit. Should blind people be allowed to use paratransit? Join us next week on Tuesday Topics when we explore this controversial subject, where in some cities blind people can use paratransit, while in others, they're absolutely prohibited from being a part of paratransit. Join us next week on Tuesday Topics on ACB Radio, the voice of the blind community.
To participate in the recording of Tuesday Topics, we invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings in the U.S. at 9 p.m. Eastern. That's Wednesday, 1 hour Universal Time. The program is recorded in the Our Place Politics chat room at ourplace.acbradio.org. The first time you enter the chat room, the software will automatically download and install on your computer. All you need is a microphone that is plugged into your computer sound card. A few minutes before each show begins, those online will be happy to assist with audio checks and to answer questions about the chat room service and how it works. An announcement promoting the topic to be discussed will be emailed to the ACB Radio Friends list early each week. So we hope you will come and join us Tuesday each week when Tuesday Topics is being recorded. Again, the URL is ourplace.acbradio.org.